Blog Talk Radio.
Driving to Baghdad?
Yes, 50-50.
50-50, what, like 50% we live, 50% we die?
Yes, that's why we drive through night. It's much safer.
How much safer?
50-50.
Bro, what the? Obviously he doesn't know what 50-50 means.
Oh my god.
Hey, what about gas though? It's a long trip, no?
No problem, petrol's free in Iraq.
No kidding. Free gas.
Yeah.
See what I'm talking about? Iraq is dope. I'm thinking about getting a place there. Free gas. Cool, man.
Alright, everybody. Welcome to Cinema Royale. I am Travis Hobson, and that was a clip from War Dogs, the latest film from Todd Phillips. If you don't know who Todd Phillips is, he's the guy who directed all three the Hangover movies. I think he also did Road Trip and Old School. So you know what kind of movie you're in for with this guy. But War Dogs is a little bit different. The way I'm liking it is, you know, if you watch The Hangover Part 3, it was a lot darker than the first two movies. And it was kind of, to me, it was kind of like practice for Phillips to get ready for a movie like this, which is still funny, but has deeper context to it. So we'll talk about War Dogs in a few minutes. But this is going to be a very interesting episode because we're going to have my good buddy, Tim Gordon of thefilmgordon.com, to talk about a serious matter that's been going on over the last few days, and it involves Nate Parker, the director of Birth of a Nation, which is a couple of months away from having its big release. It's a movie that Tim and I saw at Sundance back in January. If you follow my site, Punch Drunk Critics, then you know that Tim and I also interviewed Nate Parker for the movie. You can also find that on my YouTube page. You can watch that interview right now. He says a lot of deep things about his inspiration for the film, and we talked to him about the controversy that the movie would likely face. I don't think neither Tim or I expected this, though. And basically what's been going on is the last few days, people have been dredging up these rape allegations that were lodged against him 17 years ago when he was in college at Penn State. Now, this is not something new. Most of us have heard this before. It's been on his Wikipedia page. He's talked about it frequently. He's never shied away from talking about it. But now, on the eve of his movie, on his breakout directorial effort coming up, people have decided to bring it up again, and it's caused a lot. It's been polarizing. In fact, I've been arguing with people about this for the last few days, including right up until the beginning of the show, arguing with people about this situation. He's got his defenders, and he damn sure has his detractors. So we're going to talk about that with Tim, and I would have Tim on there, one, because he's seen the movie, two, because he's the president of the Black Reel Awards. I know Nate Parker is going to be heavily a part of those awards, at least as a contender, a nominee, and he brings a perspective on African Americans and cinema that I value, so I wanted to have him on there. And let me bring him on here now because I don't want to pump his head up anymore. What's up, Tim?
Man, I was just listening to you, man, and you know this is wow. I don't know what to say, man. I've seen,
yeah.
And you and I have talked about this. I've seen some campaigns or some some what I call smear campaigns in the past for lots of films. And we've seen them recent. They've gone back as far as the Academy, the history of the Academy. It's always been folks trying to kind of pick off, you know, the films who are the front runners or the perceived front runners in the Oscar race. But what's going on with this, man? I'm telling you, it's interesting. You said you had a conversation or discussion about this right after the show. I had an hour and a half conversation last night with a female critic who, I'm still not in agreement with what she told me, but it's apparent that I think we now live in, you know, a social media environment, and there's this herd mentality, as I like to refer to it, of people who literally don't have a lot to do, have some issues in their own lives, and anytime something comes up that kind of speaks or reflects their experience, no matter what it is, that, you know, they jump on board and lead campaigns to kind of try to torpedo certain things. So, for example,
I would agree with you on that. But let's hold off on talking about Nate Parker for a minute. And let's talk a little bit first before we jump into Nate Parker, because we may be lucky enough to be joined by our friend Wilson Morales later. We may be. He's in a movie. He said he tried to come on. We'll talk about it. He wrote a piece in THR, the Hollywood Reporter, that went up today. You wrote a piece in the Film Gordon that I'm going to ask you about in a little bit as well. I had a chance to finally read it today. Sorry, it took me a little while. I read it today, though.
Okay, no problem.
But before we start talking about all that, let's talk about a movie you and I both just saw last night. We're going to start off with something a little bit lighter. We're going to talk about War Dogs for a minute. We played a clip from that in the very beginning. And War Dogs, like I was saying, is the latest film from Todd Phillips, who made all those three Hangover movies that you love so much, Tim. But War Dogs stars Miles Teller and Jonah Hill as a couple of regular guys, a couple of Florida guys, who somehow managed to get a $300 million government contract to sell arms, to sell weapons. How do they do this? Well, that's the big part of the story. And basically what it amounts to is our government's stupid. That government is stupid, and they'll spend money on just about anything. As long as they're the lowest bidder, they'll spend money on it. When I first saw the trailers for this and I first heard the premise, the first thing I thought of was Pain and Gain. Michael Bay's Pain and Gain. It sounded exactly like that. That was a movie by another couple of regular dudes who try to pull off this big scam, and the movie ended up being really bonkers. The whole situation was bonkers, but it was kind of fun in a way. It had a lot of energy to it. This reminded me almost exactly of Pain and Gain. It didn't remind me of so much of The Hangover, but it reminded me of Pain and Gain in terms of tone and in terms of, I guess what it's saying about people in desperate situations, which is not a whole lot. It's just kind of, but in terms of tone, this reminded me exactly of Pain and Gain. But what did you think of it, Tim?
Well, I mean, you did Pain and Gain. I was thinking about Lord of War, the Nick Cage.
Oh, yeah.
That was another one of these kind of films that, you know, I guess, but for people who don't like George W. Bush, at least George W. Bush was great for one thing, that he gave us so much great material that people can make great movies about the really jacked up part of his of his presidency. And this film is another example, like you said earlier, about the military being, or the government being stupid. They hand the contract out to these kinds of guys. I thought it was a really interesting story. And looking at the trailer, you thought of one thing. I didn't think much of the film. I kind of saw it and was like, you know, kind of been there and done that. But Jonah Hill, who you could probably, you know, talk more about than I can. I don't know how much weight he put on. Looks like about 30 or 40 pounds.
He went from, he was big, and then he lost it all.
Right.
And now it's all back again.
Well, I'm assuming it was back just for this movie, but I was like, wow, man. I mean, this story is pretty interesting, and to figure out that this is based on a true story, it's like, wow. The rise and fall of two friends, man, or were they actually ever friends? I mean, when you watch the movie at the end, you got to ask yourself that question. But I thought it was entertaining. I thought even though it was loaded up with, you know, with contracting jargon, they were able to do it in a way that I thought that didn't bog the film down, play over people's heads, and then they kind of also blended in a lot of comedic elements to go along with some of the action and some of the other things that, you know, kind of the covert action that kind of went on. But at the end, I would agree with your pain and gain assessment, because for you to lose all that money because one of them was too cheap in order to pay such a paltry sum as opposed to $300 million is a stupid way to lose a contract, man.
Yeah, and it's kind of like, it reminded me in a way of the Coen brothers and some of their movies, where it's like, you know, greed seems to trump everything. But it's not just greed, it's pettiness. You know, and you know, so it's like, and I think in a lot of ways, pettiness trumps greed. because in this case, and like in most cases, it's always something small that derails something big. You know what
right.
I mean? Like in this case, you have these two guys who are making money hand over fist, and they're both being extremely greedy. Now, in Miles Teller's character, you kind of understand his reasoning for it. He's got issues at home. He's got a wife who's gorgeous, by the way. I can't remember what her name is, but she's gorgeous.
Oh yeah, she is extremely attractive.
Yes, Ana de Armas. Yeah, that's right. And I was trying to think where I'd seen her before. She was just in Hands of Stone, the boxing movie that comes out next week that I think we'll be talking about. Did you see that yet, Hands of Stone?
No. I won't see it until next week.
Okay, yeah. So yeah, she's in that. It's worth checking out, I guess. But yeah, she's in that. So he's got her to take care of. He's got a kid on the way. You know, this is a guy who's been down and out for a while. He used to be a big guy, but now he's down and out. So he's got reasons for needing to make this money real fast. Jonah Hill's character, on the other hand, is more complex, I would say. You know, because he's a guy who seems like he's just about greed, but I think there's a lot more going on with him. He's got serious personal issues involved, not just his attitude,
right?
Like his
right,
anger,
right.
But he seems
anger,
to have
his insecurities. You know, he's got a lot of, as you said, inner demons. And I think that Miles Teller's character, there's a key line in the film where he talks about, you know, this guy's almost like a chameleon, and he can be whatever he needs to be, whoever he needs to be. We don't really ever. And I think he, as a guy who grew up with him and went into business with him, he never knew who the real, I forget what the character's name was that Jonah Hill played, but he didn't even know who the real guy was. And then
right.
by the time he started really figuring out that the guy was BSing him, is that great scene with them in the elevator, and he's like, you know, really? Do you ever stop acting? No, he never does, man.
Yeah. The first time we see Jonah Hill's character, first time we see Jonah Hill's character at a funeral, he's acting. You know, it's like every time he puts on that yarmulke, he's acting. He's if he needs to play the part of the good Jewish kid, he knows how to do it. If he needs to play the part of a tough guy, like we saw when he faced down those drug dealers who stiffed him, he can do it. You know, he's a like you said, he's a chameleon, and he's a guy who's also not just a chameleon, but he's got no scruples. I mean, he's a guy who's also, you know, he's willing to screw over pretty much anybody. But you don't expect that he would do that to his best friend. You know, you don't expect that he would do that. And I guess that's sort of the central mystery of the movie, is how much can we trust Jonah Hill's character? Because that's the one thing I kept wondering about the entire movie, was how is this movie going to go? How's this thing going to end? I knew how it ends, because I knew the story. But I was like, how is their friendship going to come apart here? Because it has to at some point. And I guess that's
right.
kind of the issue. The question is whether or not you can trust Jonah Hill's character throughout all the all this shit they go through, and they go through some incredible shit, that seems like that would be a bonding situation for them. And that's kind of the mystery. Is it, or is it, or is it not? You know what I mean?
Well, I think the big question, and maybe the big red flag for me, was earlier in the movie when the guys agree to go into business and cut a 70-30 deal, and they're like childhood friends. That was a red flag to me. If I'm going into business with a childhood friend, and even though you had an existing business, if you're bringing me in, you're not bringing me in. I'm not 30, you're 30% partner, and you get 70. Like, seriously, I mean, am I looking into this? I mean, think about that for a second, Travis. If you would you go into business with a childhood friend and be a 70-30 partner or a 30-70 partner?
Well, no, I wouldn't. No matter, unless I was desperate. But then again, but he was in a situation where he was desperate. Also, he probably was willing to accept anything.
Right. But I'm saying Jonah Hill's character shows you his character. And offering somebody who's supposed to be that close to you and a friend to you that kind of deal. So his character, like I said, I think what the film does a great job of showing you is that we really never see this guy. We see him in all of these different instances and situations throughout the film. But, you know, was any of that really that character, or was that him, as you said, being a chameleon in the moment, being what he needs to be in order to get what he needs. So, yeah,
right.
I thought it was a really interesting film, and since I guess I had low expectations, I really kind of enjoyed it. Thought that that Jonah Hill and Miles Teller's chemistry worked very well, because the film is essentially those two. You have other folks who kind of orbit in and out the film, but Yeah, Bradley Cooper, really, really small but very meaningful. I almost looked at it as almost like a cameo.
it was more than a cameo. It was a supporting role. I mean, his character only gets what, maybe three or four scenes in the movie, maybe. But they're all critical scenes. I mean, they're all very important. So I would say it's more than a cameo. It's a supporting role for sure. And you know, it's cool to see Bradley Cooper in there doing his boy Todd Phillips a solid. That was pretty nice. But how would you say this movie compares to Lord of War, which is essentially telling a similar type story about, you know, running guns and, you know, how to maneuver through the system when it comes to running guns. I would say that movie was more of a morality tale than this one was. I don't know if this one had really a moral center to it at all.
Well, I think this one is not necessarily just about a moral. It's not a moral film. It's a film about friendship and trust.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, them going back, and we never really kind of see them as children, but there are lots of scenes where they kind of talk about things they went through when they were young. So apparently they had a really tight bond after he disappears and he comes back years later. But I don't know, man. I mean, Lord of War, I haven't seen that movie, man, in so many years. I know I remember what I remember about it more so than anything else was, of course, Nicolas Cage and his kind of frenetic acting style. But also I remember the editing of that film, because there was a scene early in the film where he's trying to describe kind of like this artillery, and there's this kind of long, drawn-out scene where it's shot like through the perspective of a bullet, which I was like, wow.
That was a great scene.
Yeah, man. So, I mean, I'm being perfectly honest. I know I saw this film. I know I liked it. But I don't remember a lot about Lord of War, man, because as you and I both know, we've probably seen 3,000 or 4,000 films, man, since the movie was released, man.
No, and that was if you want to feel old, that was 11 years ago, Lord of War.
Oh, my God, yeah. So I'm thinking it was about 7-8 years ago. Wow. So, yeah, man.
2005.
Yeah, but Lord of War, man, is the movie I thought of immediately when I was sitting there watching this story. But I think Pain and Gain is a good example because of, you know, it being two guys and you know, two guys who really don't sort of think through stuff, and, you know, their pettiness leads to their downfall. So you're absolutely correct, sir.
Yeah, I love the chemistry between Teller and Hill. I think they could make a lot of really funny movies together. And this movie is funny when it needs to be. It's not, if you're going in there expecting it to be The Hangover, it's not that. It's not on that level in terms of comedy. It's not trying to be either. I think this is Todd Phillips trying to make a point. And I described it earlier on as kind of like how The Hangover 3 was, which I did not think was meant to be funny either. I know people went into it expecting it to be for obvious reasons, because it's The Hangover. But the third film did not feel like Todd Phillips was trying to be funny. It felt like practice for this movie. He was trying to make that one a crime movie, and he was kind of gearing up for what he wanted to do, which is something like this.
Well, I think that's true. I think that Todd Phillips made a major miscalculation, because those first two films were so. Well, actually, the second one is literally almost like a mirror image of the first one.
It didn't really change.
They changed the locale a little, but it's almost like he made the same movie again. If the third one, there's an expectation that people have watched the first two, and they understand if you're bringing back these characters, these situations, they're looking for what you gave them the first two times out. So if you're not going to give them that, and you want to go in a different direction, there should be something in the press notes. There needs to be something when you're going doing interviews. There needs to be something that says, hey, we're looking to go in a different direction, man. Don't look for what you got the first two times. We're going to give you something different. Don't know if people would have liked it.
But if you do that, then nobody's going to come see it. If you do that, then people aren't going to pay to see it. Because he was in a no-win situation. Let's put it this way. He was in a no-win situation with the Hangover movies. Because when he made the second movie and it followed the exact same structure of the first one, people complained. So then he goes and he does something wildly different with the third one, and people complain. He probably would have been better off just not making a sequel at all. I mean, clearly the first one wasn't designed for it to be a trilogy. So he probably should have just left it alone. But there was no way Warner Brothers was going to allow him to do that. I mean, the movie was too big of a hit. You can't just leave it alone. So that's...
You're right, man. And of course, that is the ugly side of film, which we're going to get to eventually in this show anyway. So, yep, you're right.
Yeah. Before we take a break and jump into the more serious topic, did you see Kubo and the Two Strings also?
No, it's actually playing right now, man. I blew it off because, you know, my friend wanted me to be on his show tonight.
Well, that's
it's playing
that's,
right
that's you,
now.
That's good that you did that, because I saw it, so I'll talk about that at the end of the show. But you did see Ben-Hur. I know you saw Ben-Hur because you were there last night. What are your quick thoughts on the Ben-Hur remake?
30-second review, man. I think that initially I was against them remaking this movie because the 59 version is such a classic. They were able to bring a perspective to it that I thought that actually worked. They updated it. I thought that Vidal Sassoon, Ben-Hur, at the end of the movie, I didn't like what they did with the third act, man. You know, when he goes to supercuts and he comes back and it's like, and I think with Romy Downey,
Romy Downey,
obvious safe face. I think her kind of taking it and making it more about faith and forgiveness and redemption, as opposed to what the story
including
was.
Jesus isn't in. Jesus isn't in the Heston one, is he? I mean, the original one.
Oh, yeah, no, he's in the original, but he's only in it in two scenes where you there's the first scene where Heston looks at him and you don't even see Jesus' face. And then, of course, when him hanging on the cross, but she wanted to kind of, you know, make it more, you know, give Jesus kind of more, as you would call it, a supporting role in the film. And I'm not sure that, along with the ending that they changed, I wasn't really a fan of the ending at all. I was like, ugh.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, man. The ending to me felt like somebody in the studio was like, we got to make this happy. we got to do, we got to make a happy ending out of this. You know, we got to make this as saccharine and sweet and inoffensive an ending as possible. But it just did not work. But also, I felt like the scenes with Jesus, they felt tacked on. They just did not feel like a organic part of Ben-Hur's story. And, you know, I've never read the original, you know, book or whatever like that. I've never read it and probably never will. But the stuff with Jesus, and I wasn't seeing the parallel. I mean, I get that Ben-Hur was a savior of his people, really, but or at least he was supposed to be. I never got that impression. It seemed like to me he was out for revenge, period.
Well,
you know,
but the
story of Ben-Hur was supposed to be about a man saving his people. Yeah.
Right, but do you remember the original, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, see, the original, they changed it because I was sitting with Kyle Osborne last night. I said, now I've seen Ben-Hur hundreds of times, right? I said, last time I checked, it was Marcellus in the Romans that Ben-Hur lived with, and it was him that was cast off, and then he came back to exact revenge. But in this one, he's the Jewish prince. Marcellus living with him. So that threw me off for like the first 15, 20 minutes because I'm trying to figure out like, okay.
Yeah, it was reversed. It was reversed.
Yeah, you literally changed, reversed, as you said, the entire premise of what we know Ben-Hur to be to kind of create this story, you know, that spotlighted his Jewish origins and, you know, all of the stuff with, you know, these are not my people. So I don't know, man. I've never read the Ben-Hur story. The Ben-Hur story isn't in the Bible, so I don't know how true that is, if that's actually a real story, if that's something somebody created, I don't know. But it felt really strange watching it after having been indoctrinated with the first one for like 5 decades, man. Like, and suddenly, like, let's just change that story around and give them something different.
Yeah, very, very interesting. But for the most part, you know, I actually thought it did a pretty good job of, I think like you, I think they did a better job than expected in making this version of Ben-Hur stand out on its own. I was actually into it for quite a while. I was surprised by how quickly the 2 hours went by. And once we got to the chariot race, I knew that the movie was coming to an end, or at least it was nearing it. But I was surprised by how effective it was. I mean, it's simple. It's a very simple story of vengeance, in my opinion. But it's an effective one. It looked good. Directed by Timur Bekmambetov, the guy who did Wanted. It looks good. I don't know. It's a solid movie. Does it actually need to exist? No. But if you wanted to see it, if you went in to see it, I don't think you'd walk away completely disappointed, except for that ending, which is awful. But the rest that's pretty good.
Well, you know, Travis, I think that the thing that to me is the biggest letdown is that the one thing that I think that a first film does that the second film shockingly couldn't outdo was the actual chariot race itself. The chariot race in the 59 version, to me, is still superior to the one that we watched last night. And I was surprised at how saccharine that thing was with all the special effects that you could bring to that today.
Which is probably why
I felt that way. Yeah, it's like, wow, that's it? That's the best you can give me in 2016 for that race? Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, man.
Yeah,
so that's the letdown, man. Yeah.
Yep, I agree. All right, let's take a quick break, and then when you and I come back, we're gonna jump into the real reason I brought you on the show this week, which is to talk about Nate Parker in this whole situation. And as we go into break, I'll let you know now that I'm going to play the one song I always play when Tim Gordon is here. It's his favorite. It's his favorite movie song ever. So listen to that while we go into break, guys.
And usually when we see films about slavery or, you know, any literature that is not real literature about slavery, it paints the oppressor as a sociopath. That all they want to do is beat and torture so people can check out. You know, I'm not like that. That's not like me. Those bad, bad, bad. The reality is that these were people that, in their benevolence, thought that they were doing good even though they were doing bad. So, and I think in 2016, that is something that echoes. So when you think about, right, so even in the writing and the direction, Gene, where's Gene? Gene, what are you doing? Come here. So this is my college roommate, and he was the very first person I told that I wanted to tell this story. So he helped me with my research. We wrote the treatment together.
All right, and we're back. And of course, that bumper music was from The Great Beauty, Tim's favorite opening scene ever in a movie, I believe.
Amazing. Right, amazing.
It's a great scene. I was listening to it in the car today with a friend, and I was like, God, I forgot how much I like this song. And it made me want to watch the movie again. So maybe I'll watch it this weekend when I do my usual weekend movie marathon. I'll throw The Great Beauty in there. And then after that, we had a little bit from the world premiere showing of the Birth of a Nation at Sundance earlier this year. I believe, Tim, you were there for that.
I was there.
Am I right? Thanks to you, man.
Some wise critic that's hosting this show gave me his Birth of a Nation pass or ticket, and I was in the house, man. It was amazing.
Yeah. And then that bit you hear him talking a little bit about the film, which is expected to be an Oscar contender later this year. But over the last few days, it has run into quite a bit of controversy. Something that I fear could derail those Oscar plans. And I saw the movie too, and you know me, Tim. I don't necessarily think it's an Oscar movie, but I think it deserves to have people see it and have them judge it based solely on that, not on anything else. And what's been happening in the last few days is 17-year-old allegations that were levied against Nate Parker from when he was in college at Penn State, in which he was charged with rape from a woman who he had previous sexual encounters with. They've been brought up again. Now, these are charges that have not been a secret. They've been out there for a while. He's talked about them on numerous occasions. I've gone back and read many of his other accounts of this and his other interviews talking about it over the years. So he's not shied away from this thing at all. It's been on his Wikipedia page. He could easily take it down and have somebody take it down. He doesn't do that. It's there. All his interviews are still there. He talks about it all the time. Now, he was acquitted of this in 2001. His roommate at the time, who was the guy you heard introduced in that clip, Gene Celestin, I believe his name is, who was a co-writer on Birth of a Nation, he was found guilty at first. The charges were appealed and then dropped. So they were dropped because she did not want to testify. Now, the woman who made those accusations, she committed suicide a few years ago, and those revelations came out a few days ago, which has only inflamed the entire situation. Now I wanted to have you on here, Tim, to talk about this because you wrote a piece about it on thefilmgordon.com, which I read today, and I liked what you had to say. But also, as the president of the Black Reel Awards, I know that Nate Parker is going to play a big part in your awards coming up this year. So I wanted to kind of just get your opinion and let you kind of say what you wanted to say about this whole situation, the timing of it, and what you think this means for the Birth of a Nation's chances and really his entire career, because this could hurt his entire career. So what do you think?
Man, I think so much, man. That's why I'm just kind of listening to you and thinking about, you know, you and I sitting there, man, the day before this film premiered, and sitting there that 5 minutes, man, we were at the Black House talking to this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And what I thought, and you and I talked about this, I said I thought that the controversy, that there would be controversy, but I thought it would come more from political fodder. I thought that conservatives, you know, pre-election would get a hold of the film, try to use it to kind of incite voters.
We asked him directly about that. We asked him exactly about that. Like, what kind of challenge he thought he would face.
Right. I remember one question that I wrote in the piece was like, you know, Nate, several months from now, what are you going to be looking at as a challenge? And so we talked about it, right? But the thing about this story, which is disturbing to me and to so many other people, man, is that, like I wrote, Friday afternoon, man, I'm sitting at a sports bar, man, and the alert comes across my phone. And I go, and it took the wind out of my sails because I'm like, here we go. Now it begins in trying to get after the guy. But then when I read what the case was or what the allegations were, by virtue that he'd been cleared, and it happened so long ago, I thought it would be something that would happen over the weekend. It would blow up, and then by the next news cycle on Monday, we'd be out of this. But then it started picking up steam. And what I also noticed, Travis, was that a Hollywood Reporter, Variety, and Deadline almost looked like they were colluding to, like, pin the story on the top of all their pages. You got to read this, must read. And I'm going, and, you know, I started picking up the phone. I called Wilson. I talked to a couple other black critics, and we were all like, hey, man, there's nothing to report here. So I said, I'm not putting it out in front of my audience because there's nothing to report. What am I going to report? Allegations that it is old and it's not new. Then what started happening, which is the troubling part to me, is that, of course, you have, you know, folks who are not in our community who are targeting the movie and, you know, making cracks and haven't seen it. But then there are African-American women who are going after the movie and going after Parker themselves because, as I said earlier, you may have been molested or sexually abused in your own life, and you see what happened to this young lady or what you perceive to happen to this young lady being a parallel to your own experience. And as I wrote, it almost feels to me that Nate Parker is like the new O.J. Simpson. He's a guy who went through the legal system and was exonerated, but there's still this the jury of public opinion that people think that he got off on a technicality. And I think there was an exclusive yesterday about the brother who said that, said as much, and I think he got off on a technicality.
And you're right. You're right. There is that sort of idea. And we've talked about that. You know, there's, you know, really the only thing that matters nowadays in our social media culture is the allegation. Nothing else really matters at that point. The allegation is enough to have you condemned in the minds of a lot of people. And you know, in talking with folks, you know, like I did all day today, like I said, right up until the beginning of the show, arguing with people about it, including a very strong-minded black woman who I love very much as a friend. But they seem to be picking at the things he's said in recent days, you know, during this flurry of interviews. Now, Deadline and Variety are joined at the hip, so, you know, I expect them to kind of attack this the same way, but it's been numerous sites. And they keep be picking on the things he said. Now, I'll read a little bit of one of the things that's been highlighted as something that people have an issue with. And this was in The Root, which is a site that I generally think is okay. They did not like this part. I will not relive that period of my life every time I go under the microscope. What do I do when you have a certain level of success, when things start to work, things go under the microscope and become bigger and bigger things? I can't control people. I can't control the way people feel. Now, people have jumped on that statement by him as him not showing empathy or him not not being contrite enough, I guess. And, you know, he talks a lot about, you know, the fact that he's married now. He's married to a white woman, which, by the way, he's taken a lot of heat from black people for the last few years over that, a ton of heat for that, which I think is stupid. As someone who was married to a white woman, I think that's dumb. But anyway, but, you know, but but he's taking heat for this statement. And the thing I've been saying to people is, I've been asking them is, what do you want him to do exactly? What is it? What would be good enough for him to say? He's getting asked about this every day now. What are his words supposed to be? I find it amazing that somebody who was acquitted has to still act as if he was guilty. It's like they want him to still talk as if he was guilty, even though he was not found guilty. Now, as somebody in Very Smart Brothers pointed out, and on a side note, every time I go to verysmartbrothers.com, I'm reminded that the people who always tell you they're smart are the ones that aren't very smart, but I'll just leave that there. But they like to point out that just because he was not guilty does not necessarily mean that he was innocent, comparing him to George Zimmerman in that regard, which I think is absurd. But anyway,
yeah,
they want him
on the roof.
Yeah, they want him to be. It's like they want him to act guilty. I don't know what people want from him exactly. I mean, can you figure it out? I don't know what they want him to do.
Oh man, let me say this as succinctly as possible, man. And again, I was warned last night by my African American female friend that, Tim, you need to be careful because you'll find yourself in the crosshairs. But my comment is, bring it on, man. Because here's what I said on this thing, right? I think if you really examine this, man, and I kind of touched on this yesterday, and I wanted to go in harder, but I said, you know what, I do have a career to protect as well, so I can't really be but so truthful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you read the part, man, where I talked about the history of film and the history, especially through looking at the prism of African Americans in film or other minorities in film. Now, Hollywood, which purports itself to be this liberal bastion of, you know, good and righteousness, it's actually really not that. And in studying the films that are promoted to us as critics, that these are the films that we're supposed to like that feature African Americans. I mean, come on, Travis. I mean, I sat around one day and was looking through some of the films that we honored over the last 16 years of the Black Reel Awards. And I got to tell you, to be perfectly honest, man, there's some movies that if I had to do it again, I would have stepped in as founder and been like, we're not doing that film, man. You know, there doesn't need to be a Precious that we're putting out there like that. There didn't need to be, I'm trying to think of some of the other films, which I'm not going to really go out and hurt some folks. But this whole thing, man, about, you know, what's acceptable or what's acceptable that they deem is something that folks need to see. And I think it's part of, at least on the surface, is a little bit about what this Birth of a Nation thing is, man. Because, again, in order for these publications, man, who you and I both know, we've watched this. I don't ever remember, and correct me if I'm wrong, we've seen smear campaigns, but I've never seen a smear campaign come from the publication itself. It normally comes from some unnamed person, and then the publication will run it. But it almost felt like Variety, Deadline, and the Hollywood Reporter, man, had something to gain that we got to stop the momentum of this story. Nobody's seen the story yet, but we got to smear this thing enough to make it almost unwatchable. And they played it perfectly because by talking about these stories of the allegations, even with him being exonerated, it felt like, yeah, he didn't do it, but maybe he did. We got to plant enough doubt that makes it look like, well, maybe he did. Maybe he knew something he didn't know. And this scandal to me, man, is really troubling on a number of levels, man, because if you're an African-American, man, and you're trying to tell a certain story, you know, is making a film now akin to running for political office? Like if you're running for campaign and people are going to go and dig through your backstory and then use your backstory against you, no matter how far.
Movies are as political as anything else. Movies are as political as anything else, and that's the way to go. But no, you're absolutely right, though. You're absolutely right. I mean, I was always trying to figure out when I first read that first Deadline piece about it, I was like, well, who brought this up to begin with? You know, that was my first question, was who brought this back up? I mean, they made it seem as if, oh, well, Nate Parker is here to address this issue with us. And I was like, who brought it up?
I'm not going to belabor the point, but I don't want it to be overlooked. Nate Parker, the day before all this blew up, was out in L.A. accepting an award from the Sundance Institute.
Yes.
I think it was the Next Generation Award. And you and I both know he has been the darling for like 6 or 7 months. He has rode around. He has promoted his movie. Everybody wants to see it. He has been getting, you know, magazines and awards. He's been a darling. And it speaks to me, man, as, you know, I look at it like an O.J. Simpson case, a Tiger Woods case, a Michael Jackson case, that you can be as popular as you want to be in this country, man. But the one time they want to get you or they have something on you, then suddenly they can turn the tables on you in a way that is like, wait a second, didn't you just love me last week? Like, what happened between last week and today? And to me, that part is troubling, man. It really is, because that could be Travis Hobson. That could be Tim Gordon. That could be Wilson Morales. That could be anybody that sort of happens to, that you're on the defensive and you're caught in the middle of a social media firestorm, man, battling for your career. I mean,
right. And I think that his willingness to confront this issue and talk about it has actually kind of hurt him, because every single word that he says is just being turned around and used against him anyway. Now, I mean, I use as an example this whole thing that he wrote on Facebook in regards to the woman who committed suicide a few years ago. And I'll read you just a little bit from it and then tell you what I heard from my friend, like, immediately after I finished reading it. He wrote, let's see, okay, I myself just learned that the young woman ended her own life several years ago, and I am filled with profound sorrow. I can't tell you how hard it is to hear this news. I can't help but think of all the implications this has for her family. I cannot, do I want to, ignore the pain she endured during and following our trial. While I maintain my innocence that this encounter was unambiguously consensual, there are things more important than the law. There's morality. No one who calls himself a man of faith should even be in that situation. As a 36-year-old father of daughters and a person of faith, I look back on that time as a teenager and say without hesitation that I should have used more wisdom. The comment I heard immediately after I read that was, yeah, he's too concerned about himself. He's being selfish. He's being too concerned about himself. And I was like, and my response was, that's not what I took from that. But second of all, who's he supposed to be concerned about when he's found not guilty? I mean, after all these years, I'm not saying that he should be a dick about it. Now, my example about someone who was a dick about getting off of a rape charge was like Jameis Winston of the Buccaneers. He is a dick, okay? He's an asshole about it. That has not been Nate Parker. Nate Parker has not been a dick about it. He has been open and talked about it and said what he wanted to say about it and been contrite when he needed to be. He says that as a young man, he put himself in a situation he shouldn't have been in, meaning that a three-way is what the situation was. At least that's the situation we it looks to have been. So, I mean, he says he shouldn't have put himself in that position now. That's what a person who's gotten older and wiser is supposed to do, is look back and say, you know, some of the things I did were wrong, and these are things I shouldn't have been in that situation. But people look at that and they condemn him for it, which I'm like, what is he supposed to do? I just can't. I'm actually kind of just flummoxed by this, you know, because I don't. Oh shit, Wilson's on there. I don't get it, Tim. I just don't understand it. But before you respond, let me bring in Wilson Morales, who has managed to come on here for the last couple minutes of the show. What's up, Wilson?
Hey guys, how's it going?
What's up? You've been on here with Tim Gordon.
Wilson,
yeah, we hear you, man. What's up?
Good, good.
Dude, we're just talking
man,
about the
I'm troubled, bro.
Go ahead,
I'm
Tim.
In trouble. I'm just saying I'm troubled, man, because and I'll let Wilson weigh in, but I think that there's another factor here at play that I don't really want to bring it up. because I know I'll be caught in the middle of the firestorm as well, but I will call you offline and we will talk, because this to me just feels personal, and it just feels that it's based on more public opinion than on the facts itself. People don't even really care about Nate Parker in this movie anymore. It's become a symbolic of something else. I'll leave it there. But Wilson, you know, what do you got, Wilson?
Well, you know, I don't know if you guys all read the article that I did for the Hollywood Reporter, you know, and they asked me to comment on it. And then I said, okay, what's the approach that I'm going to take? You know, I'm not going to comment on the case because, you know, I have no business to comment on the case. You know, this is a situation that happened 17 years ago. It's a terrible situation. The first thing I said as a writer regarding film, and I'm sticking to what I know best, is, what does this have to do with the birth of a nation? You know, we've been talking about this film for a long time. As we go into the Oscar season, this is the only film that is like right there as far as a front runner to get a nomination. You know, no one's talked about other films. They've talked about performances, but not particularly a film, but the birth of a nation. Then I look to see how all of this transpired, and you have Variety and Deadline, who are owned by the same company. And apparently, the way I see it is, they're both in a pissing contest, meaning that we are all writers, but we have never written our article stating, like, oh, I interviewed so-and-so for 3 hours, 10 minutes, 5 minutes. Whereas the other site goes, well, we interviewed him before he went to the other site. You know, so it seemed that Variety spoke to him first, held on the story. Deadline ran the story right afterwards. Variety had to go, I guess, amend their story and say, we had him first. And I'm thinking Nightcrawler style, they had to keep the story going. So they went out and talked to the brother. And I go, well, what's the point of talking to the brother at this, you know, at this stage? And they both did it. Yeah. They ran their story on a Friday, knowing everybody's looking for a story that's going to hold over there, you know, for the weekend. You know, they didn't run it, and, you know, they ran that, you know, the brother's story on a Monday. You know, now they're running other stories like, oh, is this going to impact the Oscars? And I'm sure they're going to read other examples.
They're doing the think pieces, as you mentioned.
But why would you do? Is it going to impact the Oscars? Why would he even put that out there if there wasn't an agenda involved?
And the thing that I stated, and like I said, I'm not even going over the case. I'm not even defending Nate Parker. That's not my argument. My argument was the timing of all of this now. You know, I said, you know, you can say, okay, nobody knew about Nate Parker 10 years ago, 5 years ago, 1 year ago. You know, but now that he's in the shadow of Hollywood, white Hollywood, you know, mainstream Hollywood, now they want to put him under a microscope because he has this film regarding Nat Turner. You know, if it was some other film, they probably wouldn't have cared. And, you know, the statement that I made was, you know, had this article came out after the movie's been released, yeah, you could make that case. But we're talking, it hasn't been released yet. The gates haven't even opened yet, and they're trying to stop the horse from kicking off. And that's the argument. It's like, you know, other films have been always called, you know, Oscar buzz films have always been called into question. That's no secret. But never so much this early, you know.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, this
so what you're saying is
the case.
So what you're saying is if he had made Soul Plane 2, probably nobody would be talking about it.
You know, it's like, and the thing is that I get is, it wasn't like they dug this up. This was always on Wikipedia,
always,
is what I always said. Always on Wikipedia.
And
you know,
done, and he's
Nate
done other
Parker,
interviews where he's talked about it before. He's done
you
other
know,
interviews
and I go,
where he's talked about
you know,
it before for years.
It's been on Wikipedia since Sundance, when he's been in Eye of Hollywood. Let's see, he's gotten, I guess, I don't know what the title was, a professorship through Wiley College. He's obviously gotten a Vanguard Award. He got an award for Tribeca. There's so many people in play that are examining and looking at Nate Parker before they make that decision that they, I'm assuming they all did their due diligence just as well, saw that there, and yet no one questioned it. You know, is what I'm saying. It's like no one questioned it. It's been there all along, you know, in front of
right.
it. And yet no one questioned it. So it's like people want an argument, why am I, you know, defending him? I go, it's not a defense. I'm just questioning the timing of it all. You know, it's always been in your face. You know, maybe not the aspects of the case, you know, but there was the gist of it was there, you know. And it could have easily happened at any given time.
Wilson, I read an article, you know, where he talked about it from back in 2007. I mean, this is stuff he's been talking about this for a while. Like you said, it's not something that is necessarily new. All these people that have followed his career know about it. All these people who've been awarding him all this stuff for the last year probably knew about it.
When he decided to make this film, I'm sure the agents of the talent involved also knew about it. Because remember, Nate Parker, the first-time filmmaker. So when someone like Armie Hammer and Gabriel Union and everybody that's involved in that film, you know, they said, okay, Nate Parker's going to make a film. Let's look into this. You know, I'm sure their agents and managers also knew about it as well. You know, and that's the thing. It's like, you know, it's not a question about why it happened or how it happened. It's like, I'm just questioning the timing of it all, you know, because now no one's talking about the birth of a nation. Everybody's talking about Nate Parker. So you basically, as Tim mentioned earlier, instead of going after Nat Turner, you know, you're going after Nate Parker. You know, and you're using that instance all of a sudden to have people say, oh, I'm not going to go see it now. I go,
what I've been hearing for the last couple of days is people saying, well, I'm not going to go see the movie now. And that's exactly the kind of impact they wanted it to have. Those people who are not even going to think about going to see the movie based on almost 20-year-old allegations of which he was found not guilty is just insane to me. And it's sad.
Yeah.
It's sad because,
and,
you know,
you
I want to see the movie stand on its own.
You know, again, now I was going to say that, you know, you could say, well, someone said, well, maybe the studio wanted to get in front of this. I go, okay, you know, either get in front of it now before the Oscar race starts, before people start getting their screeners, I guess mid-October, late November, you know, they figure, you know, they're going to take the hit now, you know, come back in 3 weeks before Toronto, let's gear up for Toronto. Because it won't so much be a bigger story then, you know. I don't know if the studio probably thought how far this could get, you know, but maybe they just wanted to get it out there now before this becomes a bigger issue and it becomes DOA. Because we've seen other films in past that, you know, do you remember Zero Dark Thirty and the whole waterboarding and how that that film, you know?
Yep.
That's one film. Remember, that's a film that prior to nomination time had won every other critics award, best film, best director, but then all of a sudden that waterboarding incident came up, and then what did we find out? Catherine did not get a nomination. You know, Selma came out, they talked about, you know, she's going after Lyndon B. Johnson, she's rewriting history, you know, the machine was in, the cycle was in, and what happened? Selma gets two nominations.
Yeah.
You know, there are other factors involved in that.
Yeah.
You know,
you're right about that, Wilson. All right, guys, we're actually about to run out of time here. We're about to run out of time here. We got about a minute left. But Wilson, Tim Gordon of the FilmGordon.com, president of the Black Reel Awards. Those are coming up soon. Wilson Morales of BlackFilm.com. Go check out his piece on The Hollywood Reporter that's out right now. Guys, I appreciate you both coming on here to talk about this. We need to talk about this some more, and I'm sure that we will because this situation is not going away. But thank you both for coming on here. I appreciate you too.
Not a problem, man. All right.
Thanks a lot, guys. All right, and we are just about to get out of here. I want to thank everybody for tuning in. Where's my music? There it is. The old music. Next week's show, we're going to talk about... I haven't decided what we're going to talk about yet. I think Hands of Stone. But I'm out here. Thanks for listening to Cinema Royale. I'm Travis Hobson. I'll talk to you later. Goodbye.